Mr. Jepson, Reel 3. So, was there a plentiful supply of potential recruits?
It was never plentiful. And yet I did interview a great number of people. And of course, as time went on, my sources became extended and more names came to me. But by that time, I was beginning to exhaust the pool of potential agents.
Was someone doing this kind of work for the non-French agents?
Oh, yes. But in a much less organized way, because there were so many fewer. You see, no other country had anything like the number of resistance workers. For one thing, hadn't got the linguists. French was and Italian. Even the Italian wasn't as plentiful.
Did you know the people who were recruiting for other nationalities?
Yes. I knew Hardy Amis, who was, the fashion man. Hardy was recruiting for Italy.
Did you work with Hardy Amis closely?
No, I only worked with him in the sense if I came across an Italian speaker, I'd choose to give Hardy the name and whereabouts of the potential Italian agent. But you see, the Italians, we hadn't got as many Italians or Italian speakers in this country as we had French. And we had precious fewer of foreign language speakers for the other sections. And it was very much more, they tended to recruit in the field.
Would you discuss with Hardy Amis recruiting methods and compare notes?
No. It's such an individual thing. It would be impossible to do. He only is, I suppose, slightly envied my bigger operation.
You said that you recruited for other countries.
I didn't recruit positively. I only passed them the names and people who might be useful to them. I couldn't recruit for them because I didn't know what their needs were, you see.
What about the question of knowledge of contemporary France as it was in 1943? Did you have to keep constantly in touch with the changes that were occurring?
Well, the major change was the occupation of Germany by Germany, the occupation by Germany of France, and the increasing hold that Germany had over the social scene in France. They played themselves in inevitably by sheer association with the inhabitants.
Can you tell me about the kind of feedback you got from how the people you'd selected were performing? Was that just done informally?
Oh, yes, it was. Yes, it was. The people on operations, I would know from the operational meetings what was happening to my people, and was more than once able to suggest moving an agent to another sector as being more competent and capable of performing the operation in that sector than the person who was already in it.
Which agents that you recruited were you most pleased with?
I don't think I could pick on any one as being more pleased or less pleased with. The mere fact they were doing it was pleasing. And they all functioned extremely well. The casualties I discovered from Michael Foot were very much less than I had feared they might be. In fact, if you took the ordinary infantry regiment in a fighting in any of the sectors of where the British Army was working, my casualties were less than in the frontline infantry or any other frontline unit. For what it was worth, there were still casualties.
You said that you started the work in late 42. Can you remember when it finished, as far as you were concerned?
Yes, it finished. It finished with the... I suppose it... Well, it finished, you see, perhaps a little bit before the German surrender, because we knew the German surrender was inevitable. We knew that something was going to happen. We weren't quite certain what, but a mortal blow to the enemy effort was going to take place. In other words, the atom bomb, which we didn't know what it was, but we only knew that there was a coup coming that would more than likely end the war. But apart from that factor, there was the point that I was really coming to the end of my potential recruits. I'd tapped every possible source. And I wasn't going to take anybody from the rejects, because having rejected them, that was sufficient to tell me that I was right. You know, I wasn't going to use second best. Not only foolish and dangerous, but unfair.
When you finished, what job did you take up after that?
Oh, yes, I went to the War Office and did public relations.
What was Buckmaster like to work for? Was he an easy man or not?
Oh, yeah, very easy indeed. But you see, there again, he left me entirely to my own devices. He said, "I can't, you know, in effect, I can't do your job. You just get on with it." And it was such an individual thing. I never would mind rushing in and telling him what I was doing, even. All he wanted was, he'd been a head salesman for Ford in Europe, and quantity meant more to him than quality by nature. And this I always had to guard against. Where he wanted more recruits, I wanted, fewer. But it was an easy point to cover. He would have liked... I mean, he didn't ask me to find more, but I knew that he would like more and would have possibly accepted and taken on people that I wouldn't have, simply because they added to the numbers. As it was, I recruited 144, I believe, people altogether.
Were you given some kind of quota to aim at?
No. You couldn't. No, impossible to... If I'd been given a quota... Who was going to give me the quota? No, you see, then, I'd have refused absolutely to follow a quota, because that would inhibit my judgment. I would be trying to fill numbers and not fill quality.
Did you... keep contact with any of the agents after the war?
Peter Churchill and Odette, they got married, didn't they? Yes. And Odette and Peter hired that cottage at the top of that bumpy lane.
Just outside your house?
on the Hillbrow Road, where we turned, just that little cottage where we turned off.
As we were coming up to your house,
onto
yes.
Onto that rough lane.
So a personal friendship developed with them?
No, not particularly. You see, by that time I really was psychologically worn out. I really didn't want any more to do with it. I'd had enough. I was not frightened of what was happening to me. Well, nothing happened to me. But I just knew that I couldn't go on doing something with the same attack to the job. At about the time the job came to an end, and it had an effect on me. And you probably noticed that I tend to hesitate all the time I'm talking. This is because all these years I have absolutely refused to talk about it, because it brought back that life and death responsibility which I had so abhorred.
Did you enjoy the job or dislike
no.
it?
No, you couldn't enjoy it. Except, I suppose, that there's always a satisfaction in exercising oneself, in using oneself to the best of one's ability in a responsible job. That was what they now call job satisfaction. I knew that I was doing something that was not easy to do, that most people would find far more difficult than I was finding it, and therefore less effective in it. It just suited me from the fund of my experience and my capacity for knowing people. What it did do was develop something I'd never had before, and that was the ability to talk to people. Like a lot of writers, I was not incoherent when I started talking. But where I could choose words on paper, I couldn't choose them in conversation. Now when I get wound up, I never at a loss for a word. Never. There is one anecdote or recollection of these days, and which I think is of interest historically, and that is the character of Odette, which, as I think I mentioned earlier in the interview, that I thought if the Germans ever got their hands on her, she'd give them an extremely bad time. And in fact, what she did, she was taken to a prisoner of war camp where they had women, which was Ravensbrück. And there, before anybody knew what was happening, she had seduced the commandant. And from that position, was able to make life a lot easier for the women prisoners of all kinds, not only our prisoners, by reason of her influence over the commandant. And it was this function, this, that enabled us to recommend her for the George Cross. She did more for the war effort in the commandant's bed than she could possibly have done functioning in France as an agent.
One thing that I didn't ask you was, did you stay in England whilst you were doing the job, or did you ever move outside?
No, I stayed in England all the time. Except I went to Scotland occasionally to see how the training schools were getting on, and that sort of thing. No, I stayed in England. I didn't go to France. There was one point at which we thought we might send me, but where a liaison had broken down, and I was the only person handy who knew the two people who had to be put together to make a circuit work. But luckily it was decided that it wouldn't do, that I knew too much. There is a point that has arisen which may be of interest, and that is that this SOE story has become an ever-recurring subject, both for conversation, for interviews, for programs on the BBC, and all the rest of the media interest. Largely, I think, because it is the only romantic story of the war, because it took people from their normal lives and put them as individuals and functioning as individuals into this war of resistance in France. That is romantic. No other war story has got that element in it. And it took me some time to wonder why I was always being asked about it. And it must be because it had this personal involvement in every case of the agents whom I recruited.
But do you think that aura of romance is with hindsight, or did it exist at the time?
No, I think it is. I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. I think it is romantic in hindsight, because it is the only story of the war in which you had this element of personal involvement of ordinary people, not soldiers and sailors and airmen. It is a civilian war, and civilians at war. And in effect, this is what it was. These were civilians who went to war as civilians, not dressed up in a uniform.
Coming back to your coup de main people, I think you were saying these form the Djedbre teams.
We called them the Djedbres, yes. And most of the time they had their headquarters in Scotland, where in effect they couldn't do any harm to the rest of our occupations. They were the people whom I'd mostly the people I'd rejected as having all the physical and background qualifications that I wanted, but who lacked the ability to move about in France without being caught on account of their language accents. And they became the fund from whom we drew the coup de main people who would go in and do a job, blow up a railway line or railway turntable, which was always a very nice target because that really tied up the railways, and then would get out as best they could to making for Miranda, which was a Spanish refugee camp, where they would begin demanding to be sent back to England. And more than once, people would ring me up from the War Office who didn't know what was going on and saying, do you know anything about a man called so-and-so in Miranda prison camp, refugee camp in Spain, who's screaming and yelling for you to do something about getting him out of where he is? And that was always a bit of a laugh. One of the best of the coup de main people was a man called Lodwick, John Lodwick, who was a writer and an adventurer. And he went in and blew up a railway line and then started going, not as other people went, which was very often by train, down to Spain and into the Miranda refugee camp. He walked there, and he walked on the sleepers of the railway line, getting off it whenever a train came along. And his only complaint about walking all the way from wherever he'd been working in France, all the way to Miranda on the railway line, was that the sleepers put splinters in his feet. And that was John Lodwick.
How did he spell his name? Can you
recall? L-O-D-W-I-C-K. I remember now you asked me earlier in the interview if there was any particular agent that I remember and admired, and the name and the thought of Harry Ray came into my mind. Harry Ray was really a first-class agent. He was highly intelligent, witty, and amiable. I can't remember exactly what operations he took part in, but he'll tell you because he's still alive and well, and became, I think, headmaster of Westminster, didn't he? Is that in your recollection?
I can't recollect that, but I think he became a professor.
Yes, that's what it was. He became a professor and I think taught at Westminster. I liked him very much. He really was a good chap. And I can remember when I interviewed him, thinking immediately, here's a good one. And I'd hardly had to explain to him at all what the work was. He knew instinctively what I was after. Very, very good indeed.